Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Dr. Hilary Bush, PhD, and she is the co-author of the Motivation Mindset Workbook. Hilary Bush, PhD, is a psychologist in private practice in Boston, where she provides neuropsychological assessments and therapy for children, teens, and young adults. And she is the co-author with Dr. Ellen Broughton, who's the founding director of the Learning and Emotional Assessment Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and associate professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Hilary.
Thank you, Monica. I'm thrilled to be here.
Is it okay if I just call you Hilary, or do you prefer something more formal?
Okay. I insist on it. Call me Hilary.
Okay. So the Motivation Mindset Workbook grew out of a book that Dr. Broughton had written that I actually had her on the show a couple years ago now to talk about that book. It was, the title was Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less or something like that. Did I get it right? Yeah, Bright Kids
You
Who
sure
Couldn't
did.
Care Less. Yeah. So tell me about why the two of you decided to do this workbook.
Thank you for asking. So this came about, I actually went back in my emails right around the time this workbook came out to see when it all really got started. And I saw that there was a pitch from me to Ellen to adapt Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less into a workbook in January 2023. That was a few months before Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less was about to be published and to launch. And I was very much involved in that process and assisting Ellen through it since we work so closely together. And I am such a fan of her work and her writing and Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less in particular, that I knew that there was something really, really special here. And a workbook seemed like a really practical way into getting it into more hands and to helping even more kids and more professionals and more adults who work with kids and support kids to really benefit from the great content of that original book.
So how did you and Ellen first meet or get to know each other?
We go way back. So we go back to early 2015 when I was applying for my internship. Every clinical psychology doctoral student needs to complete a one-year internship in addition to writing their dissertation. Very fun, by the way.
Which part? The internship or the writing? All of it. Okay.
So the internship process for clinical psychology students works a lot like the match system for students who are graduating from medical school and are going on residency. So you apply to sites that you think might be a good fit. They might invite you for an interview. And then each applicant makes a rank list, each site makes a rank list, and the computer, the algorithm works its magic. So I had applied for my internship at Mass General Hospital, specifically to the LEAP program, the Learning and Emotional Assessment Program, where Dr. Broughton is the founding director. And I wish that were the beginning and end of our story, but it wasn't. I loved this internship site, but the feeling was not mutual at that time. So I ended up not matching there, but I had a fabulous internship. The algorithm really did work the way it was supposed to. What happened was I went away. I went to Indiana for internship, which again was for the best. But I knew what I felt at MGH, and I knew how much I looked up to Dr. Broughton and just how much I could learn from her and what great work we could do together. So fast forward a year later, 2016, I'm finishing my internship. I'm applying for postdocs. I'm thinking about my big girl job as a psychologist. And I reapplied to the site where I hadn't matched before. And that felt like a putting myself out there moment. No, really. I think there's something there, and I'm different. I've changed. I've evolved from who I was a year ago. I'm a different applicant in some ways now. And it turned out that the second time was the charm. So even though I didn't come to Boston to Mass General for internship, I did end up coming for postdoc. And that's where Ellen was my clinical supervisor. After that year finished, that training year of postdoc, I stayed on as a faculty member and an attending psychologist for 3 years. And the while I've been working with Ellen in her private practice as well, doing assessment work. So ever since 2016, when I came for postdoc, our relationship, and most recently, our writing relationship, has been continuous ever since.
Oh, fantastic. So becoming a clinical psychologist sounds like a pretty long road, education-wise.
It is.
Pretty complex. What inspired you to want to do that in the first place?
Oh, thank you for asking. I love having chances like this to reflect on where I've come from, what the path looked like, and why I got on it in the first place. I'll share that I did not study psychology when I was in college. I did not take a single psychology course I was in college, which isn't what most people in my shoes say. But for me, the realization that clinical psychology could be a really good fit was a putting together of the pieces, a putting together of the life experiences that just took longer for me. It just took longer. It wasn't until I had graduated from college that I was able to look back at the experiences that shaped me. By this, I'm thinking about my work at McDonald's as a teenager. I'm thinking about my work with adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities, which started as volunteer work and became paid work. Thinking about my first job, which was in marketing, and all of the psychology that is woven into marketing. And thinking about what actually were my college majors, which were American Studies and Spanish. Ah. It was a putting together of these cultural, interpersonal, social science pieces that I landed on psychology and realized that it could really be my best bet and my best fit for my interests, my talents, what I bring to the table. And once I landed on it, I was all in and have been ever since.
So you had an undergraduate degree, and then I assume you had to do a master's degree. Of how long was that?
So in my case, I earned my master's degree en route to the PhD.
Okay.
Some folks get a terminal master's before entering a PhD program, but that turned out to not be my case. What I did do in between undergraduate and graduate school was that I went back to school. I took continuing education courses at UMass Boston and basically did the psychology undergraduate coursework that, had I been more self-knowing at the time, I would have done while I formerly was an undergrad student.
Okay.
I also got research experience. I volunteered in one psychology research lab. Then an opportunity for a part-time paid research position came about. I also worked full-time in the community. For 3 years, I worked at the same agency where I had volunteered in high school, working hands-on as a direct support provider for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities, like Down syndrome and autism and cerebral palsy and intellectual disability and more.
Wow. Okay, so it's just mind-boggling to be at the beginning of that educational journey and think, okay, I'm going to do this and it's going to take 10 years, until I'm at the other end, but man, I'm going to do it. And of course, you broke it up a little bit. I guess you did, not going straight from undergrad to grad school. But yeah, I don't know if I would have had the motivation to do that. So now the question is, if somebody is at a early point in their life and trying to figure out what they want to do, can the motivation mindset workbook help them become motivated to do what you did or something like that?
I certainly hope so. And that was a goal in writing it. I think a lot of my own experiences and my own path and a lot of the things I just had to learn the hard way by being a person are woven into this book. I tried to write the book that I wish my younger self could have had access to while I was figuring out all these things.
So the subtitle of the book is Helping Teens and Tweens Discover What They Love to Do, which could apply to all teens and, all young people. Most or almost all need help discovering what they love to do. Although I have one young person in my life who made a decision when he was about 10 years old, maybe even younger, about what he wanted to do. And he hasn't wavered from it in the slightest. He's 16 now. He's still very much on that path. And it's in a creative field. And when I, one time I said to him, because we were all talking about, okay, where you should go to college, what you should do, about to become this. And I said, but I need to tell you something. He goes, yeah, I know. You need to tell me I probably won't make it. It probably won't happen. I said, no. That's not what I wanted to tell you at all. What I wanted to tell you is that we're all really enthused about this, and you made this decision when you were really young, and you're allowed to change your mind. You don't have to stay with this if it's not really what you want to do, just because we're all pushing for it. And he said, well, what else would I do? And I said, well, there's all kinds of things. And I he goes, yeah, but anything else would be boring. Just so
Oh, I love this story,
isn't it
Monica. Thank
great?
you
Isn't it a
for
great
sharing.
story? So he definitely we don't doesn't have an issue with motivation, but how prevalent is a lack of motivation in teens and tweens? Because it isn't just helping, people who aren't sure what they want to do. That could apply to everyone, but it seems like there's a lot of people who just don't seem to care about anything, and that's why Dr. Broughton wrote that other book and how to help those kids. How prevalent is that?
So it depends on how we measure and what we count as low motivation. I would argue that motivation is not a fixed trait that you either have or you don't. It's transient, right? It comes
Right.
and goes, it ebbs and flows. And
Yeah.
to the extent that there are valleys, and this is normal. This is normal. I would say everyone, whether you're young or you're old or somewhere in between, everyone knows what it feels like to have lagging motivation. Some people have this feeling more so than others, but not feeling like doing the things. Like, let's normalize that.
Well,
let's not pretend that's not a thing.
yeah, it's for me it's interesting because I'm at the other end of the life experience where I'm of retirement age and looking to slow down a little bit. And so to me it's like I have to normalize not being motivated every day.
Finding balance,
Yes,
right?
yes.
And we wrote this book, of course, with our tweens and our teens in mind, who inevitably have a lot going on. And everyone who's young is facing certain pressures, and they can be very normal and very developmentally appropriate. but hard all the same. And at the same time, our hope was that the material, and especially the central theory, like the linchpin of Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less, and now the Motivation Mindset Workbook, that it actually could be helpful to anybody. It's not restricted to a certain age, even though we did have a certain age range in mind when we wrote it.
Now, if a child is really unmotivated, and maybe depression is part of that and so forth, is it difficult to get them interested in doing these exercises in the workbook?
You bet. You bet. I can't promise, like, this is a magic book. It solves every problem. I wish, but I don't know how to write that. The hope here, when folks are depressed, and also when folks are dysexecutive, when they're overwhelmed and can't get started because it all just seems like too much.
Wait, what was that term that you said? Dysexecutive?
Oh, dysexecutive. I'm talking in jargon. This largely means being out of sorts, overwhelmed, not on top of things, not able to do the things that one wants to do or that one needs to do.
Does it mean so your executive functioning, the executive functioning part of the brain isn't really kicking in?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep. And oftentimes if someone is depressed, then it's really hard to function. Probably that this is part of the picture too. A long way of saying is that when someone is having a hard time stepping up to the plate, because things seem so overwhelming and there's not a clear starting point, the common advice is to break it down. Whatever the thing is, break it down as small enough as it needs to be so that you can do the first step. And let the first step usher you into the second step and give you the boost you need to do the third step. It's a long way of saying that this book is a lot of first steps.
Ah, okay.
It's a lot of first steps. So it might take effort. It might take an involved rooting for you adult to make a copy of what's in here and to put a worksheet in front of you and to walk you through it and to ask you to think about it. But this is meant to be a book of first steps and idea sparkers and conversation starters.
That sounds like something that could be very, very useful.
That's our hope.
Yes. So when you decided to write this workbook, how did you start? What was the process like? You know, did you have some of these worksheets or exercises that you were already using in your practice? You know, what was that? Or did you create everything from scratch?
So it started with me taking a chance and saying some scary words, which were, "Ellen, I have a wacky idea. Do you want to hear it?" And Ellen, to her credit, is like, "I love wacky ideas. And I'm also sure it's not so wacky." And I let her know, like, being heart-led, like, I loved Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less. Getting to work behind the scenes with you on this launch and thinking about how we can talk and share about this book. There's something really powerful here. And I would love to develop it even further and in some ways break it down, like bite-size it even further. And I think we would have an audience. I think it would be a win-win-win-win-win across the board. I think it would be a win for you, a win for the public, a win for different professionals, a win for kids, a win for our publishers, a win for, I think there's something here. And writing a book has been something I've dreamed of and have planned for forever. And there were times where it was very top of mind, different times in my life where it took more of a backseat, but that desire has always been there. This is truly a dream realized to be holding and talking about this book that now exists. And for me, it seemed like, in a very practical way, an entry point, like a solid idea that can help people, that can do some good, and that can also be my first book.
Okay. All right. So she said yes.
She said yes.
And then what was the collaboration process like?
Okay. So Ellen then pitched the idea to her editing team at Guilford. And it was so exciting that her editing team became my editing team too. I became part of the pack. We worked very closely with Kitty Moore and with Christine Benton, who were guiding lights and helped me learn so much on my feet about how books get written and published. It was also fabulous having a co-author and having the scaffolding and the guidance from Ellen, who's written many books, who's been down this path before. But it was, I don't think anything was lost in co-writing this book as a first book. If anything, it was only gains. It was only beneficial for me to have a partner in writing a first book.
Okay. All right. So do you want to share a little bit from the book with us?
I would love to. Thanks for the invitation to share from it. I would love to start by reading some of the introduction that Ellen and I prepared. So this is the introduction for parents and professionals. There are few things more frustrating than being the parent, teacher, or therapist of an unmotivated child. Unmotivated kids don't fit into a single category. They're not just depressed, or anxious, or disorganized, or learning disabled, or addicted to video games, just to name a few of the behaviors unmotivated kids might display. Some unmotivated kids have a lot of these behaviors, and others have almost none, but they all share one trait. They don't seem to care a whole lot about much of anything. Parents, other caregivers, and teachers of these kids tend to feel hopeless, helpless, and worried about the child's future prospects. Getting them back on track can feel like an impossible task. In 2023, one of us wrote a book about these kids called Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less. The book explored the issue of kids who didn't care from many different vantage points, from understanding a child's individual differences to reflecting on what might have caused a child to lose interest. Parents were encouraged to analyze their own expectations and reflect on their child's unique qualities and were taught how to set goals. But many parents, teachers, and clinicians wanted more practical, experiential activities. They wanted things they could do. And in that spirit, this book was born. This book is organized around three central guiding lights, those being aptitude, so the things that you are good at or could become better at with practice, pleasure, which is what it sounds like. It's the things that you enjoy doing and that make you feel happy and good when you do them. And then practice, so the things that you actually spend your time doing in practice. And that is the central model or framework of Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less. And it's also our central framework or model here in the Motivation Mindset Workbook. Do you think it might be helpful if I shared a sample activity from the aptitude section?
That would
pleasure
be great. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. And again, these are all worksheets. Each section of the book has a brief intro that is for the adults reading and guiding the child. But the activities themselves, each worksheet is written and designed for the child to fill out for themselves. So having said that, me sharing is not going to fully translate or fully capture what's in front of me, but hopefully this will give you a taste of just the tone and the style and the nature of these first step activities as I was describing them before.
Right. And there's dozens of them in the book, right?
There are. I don't know. At some point, I knew exactly how many. But I would guess there's a bunch.
Yeah, I would guess over 50 at least.
Over? Exactly. Yeah. I would too.
Yeah.
And of course, in the writing and editing process, there's a lot left on the floor.
Oh, I bet.
For every activity that's in here, there's probably three that aren't.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, we'll come back to that. Yeah, about what made you decide what made the cut. But okay, so let's look at aptitude.
Yes, so an activity that I'll share from our aptitude section is called people who motivate me, .. and people who don't. You interact with lots of people every day. Your mom, dad, friends, teachers, coaches, and grandparents, just to name a few. Interacting with others has a big impact on how motivated you feel or don't feel. For this activity, think about the people you spend the most time with. You can draw a picture or write their names in the frames below. Give each person a rating from 0, not at all, to 10, the highest, to reflect on how often or how much they motivate you. Then briefly write why you gave each rating. Throughout the book, we have a lot of quotes from sample kids, because sometimes having an example can spark something and get the juices flowing. So the example we have on this activity is from Mila, age 14. And here's what she had to say. I would give my Nana a 10. She believes in me so much, even when I don't.
Okay, so this is interesting, but it's like not everyone in your life should motivate you, really, right? So giving somebody a low motivation score doesn't mean that they aren't important in your life in other ways, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there are activities later in the book that are geared toward helping the helpful adults, the well-meaning adults in a kid's life, do even better at that.
Wow.
There's an activity, that speaks to that very specifically.
So what would some other examples of how kids might have filled this in? You know, what reasons that they would give for giving people ratings?
Oh, great question. I'm going to think about or put myself back in my 14-year-old shoes for a moment. And I would say, I'm thinking of the flute teacher that I had when I was in middle school and in high school, who I saw every week for a one-on-one lesson. And she was so dear to me and so inspiring to me. If I were filling this out as a 14-year-old, I probably would draw her, because there are frames on this page and the encouragement to draw a little doodle or draw a little picture of the person you're talking about. I would draw Erica, and I would say, I would give her a 10. And I would say, being with Erica and hearing her stories and getting her feedback is a bright spot in my week. And I, even when I don't always feel like practicing my flute, I can muster the will to do it when I think about Erica and getting to have my lesson with her soon.
Wow. Okay. What's an example of someone you would have not ranked as identify, and you don't have to name names.
But what if I want to name names? I'm just kidding. I'm not going to name names. I would say certain teachers come to mind. I'm like, oh, I'm self-monitoring. I'm like, how much do I say?
It's hard,
Monica. I guess when I was in middle school, there was a subject that I had to take that every student in the school that I went to had to take. And I did not like the subject. And as soon as I could stop taking the subject, which came once high school arrived, I stopped taking the subject and started taking a different one.
Home ec.
Oh no, I wish I could have taken home ec. Are you kidding me?
Okay.
Oh no. I'll tell you later.
Wink, okay, wink. All right.
But when I think about the teacher, when I think about the other students, when I look back on it, I was like, yeah, it was really hard to stay motivated. And at the time, I had a narrative that it was all my fault and my lack of motivation was a moral failing or an intellect problem, or that I was a problem because I'm not feeling this class the way a lot of the other students around me seem to be. And that's not helpful. And rarely, and that's a really important point I would like to make here, and also try to make throughout the workbook, that a lack of motivation is not a moral failure. And it's rarely, if ever, an individual personal problem. It's usually a context. And very often for children, for teens, what can look like a motivation problem is often a mismatch problem between the child's aptitudes, pleasure, practice, and maybe what the well-meaning adults in their lives think their aptitude, pleasure, and practice should look like.
Interesting. So, you know, when you started talking about your flute teacher, then mm-hmm. I flashed back to middle school, and we actually moved in the middle of ninth grade, and I came.
You did?
Yeah, and halfway across the country and came to a new school, and I was in band, I played an instrument, and I was very, very uncomfortable with the band instructor. And because I was the only person who played that instrument. It's an unusual instrument. Or not unusual, but it's not it's not a trumpet or a clarinet like everybody plays.
Or a flute. Everybody plays that.
So my lessons were supposed to be private, and I just felt so uncomfortable alone in a room with this guy. And he probably was completely innocent. I don't know. I felt he stood too close to me. That was the problem. Mm. He stood too close. And mm-hmm. I'm a person who needs my personal space. And sure. I just quit going to my lessons.
Okay.
Yeah, I just quit going because I didn't tell anybody. I never talked to anybody about it.
Yeah, I'm sorry that happened.
Yeah, and I didn't quit playing the instrument. And then when I got into high school, I was fine with the teacher there, and so I continued. But maybe I would have been better if I hadn't, had that gap in my learning of it. I may have gotten more skilled on the instrument. So you're right. It was definitely a mismatch. And I'm not pointing a finger because I don't know that there was anything untoward in his intentions at all. It was just a match of style or a mismatch of style.
Yeah. And your feelings are valid. Right? Your feelings are valid. If it didn't feel right to you, that's a fact.
Yeah.
I'm dying to know what instrument was it?
The baritone horn.
Ooh. I love that.
Yeah, it's a very cool instrument, really. I love the sound of it, and like I said, not very many people choose that as a starting instrument. I did because I had to choose an instrument that the school would provide for free.
Okay.
And so that meant tuba, baritone, baritone sax, you know, basically one of the really big instruments that the school doesn't expect families to go out and purchase. So, and back then, I don't think you could even rent instruments. They had to be purchased. And so that's why I ended up playing the baritone.
Thank you so much for sharing your
Yeah.
story. No, those sound like very, very valid reasons for playing the baritone horn.
Yeah, we yeah, it's I love playing. I love being in the band. I really did, but yeah. So anyway, that it was just a case in point of the motive, you know, that some people motivate you and some people do not. And I had a speech teacher who was really motivating, you know.
Oh.
Yeah. And she was kind of difficult in a way, but boy, was she good. And she, I think she motivated a lot of us to be better at speech. And she was also my newspaper advisor. So when I was on the school newspaper. So,
Isn't that fabulous when you get
yeah.
to do different things or to keep going with someone
Yeah.
who's really motivating to you?
Yeah. All right. So now let's look at pleasure.
I have an activity from our pleasure section, and this activity is called Surprising Fun. We are often very good at predicting the things we will enjoy and the things we will not. Sometimes, though, fun can take us by surprise. This can give us new information about who we are and what we like and what we don't like, which is important information too. For each of the prompts below, write a few words or draw or paste a picture or an emoji to remind yourself about each time this has happened to you. These are the four prompts that we ask the child or teen who's doing the activity to reflect on and then to fill something in about. The first one is a time that you thought something was going to be very fun, and it turned out to be just as fun as you thought. The next prompt is a time that you thought something was not going to be very fun, but it turned out to be more fun than you'd expected. The next prompt is a time that you thought something was going to be very fun, but it turned out not to be as much fun as you'd thought. And the last prompt is a time that you thought something was not going to be fun, and you were totally right. It wasn't fun at all. We have, like on the previous activity, we have a little blurb from another kid. This is from Simon, age 16. I was really excited to go snowboarding for the first time, but I spent the whole day falling down on my butt. It ended up being hard, painful, and not much fun for me, even though I know lots of kids really like it, and I thought I would too. I'm probably not going to go snowboarding again, but I'm glad I tried it.
Interesting. Interesting. Do you have an example of something that you thought would be fun and turned out not to be?
Here's a big secret. I'm Simon.
Oh! Very good. Very good.
Except I wasn't 16, I was 22. When I went snowboarding for the first and only time, I thought it would be great. And for a lot of folks, it is, but not for me. But at least I know that now through trying.
How about skiing? Do you ski?
So I took some pages from this book, and later in the pleasure section, and also tipping over into the practice section, one of the things we ask the reader or the child to do is to use what they already know about themselves to come up with some new ideas for new ways of having fun that track, that line up, that are maybe a little offshoot from fun you've had before. a long way of saying I had hypothesized for a long time that cross-country skiing might be fun for me. And I put it down as a 2025, like, New Year's aspiration. I don't make resolutions, but I do write down aspirations of the things I would like to try and do and experiences I'd like to collect that year. And literally on New Year's Eve, so on December 31st, 2025, the last possible day of the year I could do it, I signed up for and took a group cross-country skiing lesson. And it was my first time ever. And I just turned 40 being on a pair of skis.
Oh my goodness. Well, congratulations. I will say had a similar experience to Simon in skiing, and I was older. I was an adult. You know, living in Iowa, there's not a whole lot of opportunities to go skiing. We do have some small ski slopes here. And one time I went with some friends and my husband at the time and my kids, and we went to one, I think, at Dubuque, Iowa. And the problem was it was so icy. The snow was so icy that every time I stood up, I'd just slide. Even if I was standing up sideways to the hill, I'd be sliding down sideways. So that's not a good way to learn to ski, is on an icy snow. And that I haven't tried it again since. And that was, what, 35 years ago, probably, or more?
A long time ago. I think a big gist of this book, and I think this lines up with what you were just sharing, is just the beauty and value that there is in collecting experiences and test driving your hypotheses, especially if there are hypotheses about things that might be fun for you, or things that might feel motivating for you, or things that you need to just know more about. We can hypothesize and think and go around in circles all day. There's no substitute for getting out and doing and trying. And you don't have to like everything you try.
Right.
And trying something and having it not be your thing, I don't think that that's a failure. I think that's a win.
Also,
I think the failure happens in the not trying.
It is possible that something that was not fun for you at one point in your life, you may find really fun at another point too.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's I'm pretty sure that there's things that I do now for fun that I would have thought totally boring when I was a teenager.
Oh my gosh, I had an experience that totally maps onto this. It was a couple of years ago that I went back to Wellesley College, where I graduated and did my undergrad, for the 15th year reunion. And I'm telling you, it was so funny and so different to be with my friends who are also in their late 30s back on campus, experiencing this place and all it has to offer with the sensibilities of an almost 40-year-old versus a teenager, which I was when I was in college. Like, we went to the Arboretum and we went to the greenhouses and we were like, why didn't we go here when we were teenagers? And it's like, well, actually, you know why.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, Hillary, let's look at practice.
Let's do it. So practice is how you spend your time. And making sure that you have enough time to do the things that matter. And a big part of it, especially for kids and teens, especially in 2026, is having a careful eye towards overscheduling.
Yeah.
Because talk about a motivation zapper. If you are stretched so thin and have no time and have no energy because you're doing oh so much, good luck with your motivation. Just let me know how that goes. So the activity that I'm going to share from this section, it's one of my favorites from the whole book. It's called Pruning My Activity Tree. It probably sounds pretty obvious, but one of our main goals is to help you figure out and invest in the activities that you are good at, like doing, and do as often as you can. However, many of us still like to do things even when they do not come naturally to us, and we have to work hard at them. Also, you might find that you have aptitudes in certain areas that don't actually bring you much pleasure. This is all normal and okay. Knowing which activities you do not enjoy and find yourself avoiding is useful information, maybe just as helpful as knowing what you do like. There's a callback to an earlier activity. Look back at your ratings on taking stock of my activities. Do you have any low marks? Find the activity with the lowest rating and write it below. The following questions can help you decide whether to keep going with the activity or to prune your activity tree and spend your time doing something more motivating. So the child is asked to write in their activity with their lowest rating. And here are the prompts to think about that activity. The first one is, why do you do this activity? The next prompt is, what would be good about ending this activity? The third one is, what would be hard about ending this activity? And the fourth prompt is, if you ended this activity, what would you do with the time you currently spend on it? And here's the conclusion. Remember, ending an activity, even one you don't like, can be hard to do because complicated factors are often involved. You can use this worksheet to help you decide what to do and then share it with your family. And we have an example from Kai, who's age 15. Again, just to spark something and get the ideas flowing. Here's what Kai had to say. Through elementary school and middle school, I took private flute lessons in addition to playing in the school band. The summer before starting high school, I talked with my dad about continuing to play in the band, which is fun for me, but stopping private lessons, which are a lot less fun for me. I was nervous to talk with him about it because I thought he'd be disappointed, but he ended up being supportive.
Interesting. And you are listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Dr. Hilary Bush. We're talking about the Motivation Mindset Workbook, helping teens and tweens and everybody really discover what they love to do. Now, there's another chapter or a couple more chapters in here after these. How are they structured?
That's right. So after the three main sections on aptitude, pleasure, and practice, we have a following section called Pulling It All Together. So this section is somewhat briefer than the three preceding it that do the deep dive. And those sections also take up thinking about the past, thinking about the right now, using this information to make some plans for the future. Pulling it all together is really pulling together and finding that overlap or that Venn diagram middle of aptitude, pleasure, and practice and what to do about it. Some of the activities in this section are called pulling it all together, setting good goals, clearing my path. There's also some information around fixed mindset versus growth mindset. And finally, an activity called goal stories. This is something that I had so much fun designing along with Ellen. We encourage the child to talk with someone in their life and to get stories, like get oral histories from the people in their life about a time where someone set a goal, went after it and achieved it, and what they learned, but also the flip side, a time they set a goal, went after it, didn't achieve it, or it didn't turn out the way they thought, and what they ended up learning instead.
Okay. And then the final chapter, a few other things. that can get in the way of motivation.
That's right. This is a section that is a way of troubleshooting and identifying and working with some factors that are relevant for motivation that might not fit super neatly into the aptitude, pleasure, practice model. So the activities in this final chapter, other things that can get in the way, we have one called signs and signals of not caring. So really helping someone to identify if they're feeling stuck and all the different ways that that can look like, because it's possible that someone could be stuck but not quite have the vocabulary or be able to realize what's going on in real time. So we have an activity for kind of sparking that insight and recognizing it if it's happening. We also have a worksheet that has to do with sleeping better and encouraging good sleep hygiene, taking stock of what your sleep hygiene looks like right now, but also thinking about how it could be tweaked, because we know how important sleep is, and it's important for everything, motivation included. If you're not sleeping well, probably a lot of things aren't going well. There's an activity that has to do with moving more and incorporating physical movement into day-to-day activities. There's also an activity related to screen time, and again, taking stock about how the kid or teen filling this out is using screens, what that relationship looks like, whether it's helping or hurting their motivation for other things. There's an activity called relaxing better. So thinking about bodily, like sensational relaxation. And then there's a final activity called opposite day. And this has to do with opposite actions, thinking about what you do right now and how things look for you, where you are. And if suddenly tomorrow were opposite day and you were to do really the radical 180, different opposite of what you do right now, just being imaginative and thinking about what that would look like.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So let's circle back to, you had mentioned earlier that you had many times more exercises that did not make it into the book. How did you prune it, and why did you know? How did you make the decision what did and didn't, and also how did you come up with so many different concepts?
Oh, thank you. I'm really, really proud of what is in here. A big chunk of my, if you're wondering what my soul looks like, it looks like this. I don't identify as an artist, but I definitely identify as a crafter and a maker. I love arts and crafts. I love making. And I really do love art too, even without having that specific heavy or very specific identity attached to it. I don't think of myself as an artist. This is all a long way of saying that creating these worksheets and designing them and generating the ideas and packaging them, it scratched some very itchy creative itches of mine. And it did feel like arts and crafts. And times it felt even, it really felt like a hybrid between writing, but also crafting, which made it the perfect book for me to write first.
Oh, interesting.
And when we were cutting activities, sometimes that had to do with redundancy. Sometimes it had to do with just feeling kind of meh about it. Every activity, I would ask myself a simple question, which I learned from my really, really dear friend, Anna. She always asks me, and in turn, I asked myself each time I was debating an activity and whether it made the cut, does it make my heart ping, or does it make my heart thud? And that's actually a It was a really helpful bar. And every activity in here is a definite ping on my end. It was also great having a co-author, getting to do all of this with Ellen and working with such insightful, experienced, totally on point editors. And sometimes having to figure out, like, it really had to be a unanimous heart ping in order to make it into the book. And one thud meant you're cut.
You're out.
You're out.
One buzzer, one. All right. Well, we're almost out of time, Hillary. I did want to mention, I saw that this is also available as an ebook, but how does that work in terms of the worksheets and so forth?
So it is our goal to get this into as many hands and minds as we can. And having an ebook version felt important and useful, just given how people use technology. So we wanted options for our potential readers. And if someone's doing the ebook version, then maybe they're not jarring or illustrating, but maybe they're using their keyboard to type in their answers. This is a book where we fully expect and encourage people to make copies of it. Like, I know that that's actually pretty funny for a lot of books where usually it's like, don't copy, like, not authorized, don't do that. Yeah. This is it's opposite day, because I totally envision, it is our sincere hope that a teacher or a counselor might have this book and then make 20 copies and distribute it to their class so that they can write and fill in. And this does, I think, lend itself to individual therapeutic and coaching situations, but I think it lends itself to larger group ones too.
Wow. So the ebook version, the worksheets are fillable on the ebook. You can type them. That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Hillary. And, you know, we always end with a quote. And one of my favorite people to quote is Mark Twain. And here's what, and this circles back to what you said about this being first steps. Mark Twain said, "The secret of getting ahead is getting started."
Really? I think he knew what he was talking about.
I think he did. So thank you so much for being with us, and see you all next week on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Monica.